today, I'm very excited to be interviewing a woman who was the first British woman to motorcycle around the world in the early 80s. Now an architect who lives in a water tower, she is Elspeth Beard and her book is Lone Rider. Hi, welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Hello, thank you.
So, first of all, what was the most scary moment? I know there were loads of them because I've read the whole book, in the momentous ride that you remember most kind of clearly when I said that to you. What came into your mind?
Probably the first one was my accident in Australia when I cartwheeled my bike. Even though, even to this day, I have very little memory of it, it was probably my biggest accident that I had. And
how did it happen?
Well, I was riding on a dirt road in the outback in Australia, in Queensland, and I think my front wheel just went into a huge pothole. And then because I had so much luggage on the back of my bike, the whole weight of the back of the bike just flipped forward and I literally cartwheeled it down the road.
God, and how were you at the end of it?
Well, I had concussion and I was in hospital for about 10 days, I think. And then I had to spend a week repairing my bike and getting better. And then I...
So that freaked you out a bit?
It did. And I think it was a sort of bit of a... I think it sort of made me realise how easy it was for things to go wrong at just sort of kind of moment's notice, where you think you're all sort of in control. And then suddenly something just completely... you know, unexpected happened to you, where you have no control at all. And I think it just made me really think about what I was doing.
Exactly, exactly. Now, first of all, Elspeth, I've got to say, why did you decide to do this momentous thing?
Well, that's quite a complicated. It was a combination of factors. When I started riding bikes when I was about 16, I got my first motorbike when I was 17, which was just a small little 100cc bike that I used to use to ride around London because it was cheap and efficient. It was the best way of getting around. Then I bought a 250, and then about a year later, I then progressed onto my BMW 600. And I suppose it was my 600 was the first, that was probably the first time when I suddenly realised the travelling potential of a motorbike.
Okay.
So suddenly a bike wasn't just a question of getting A to B around town. Suddenly you could travel and you could explore and you could go places. So my first trip I did was up to Scotland, which I did on my own, and then I went around Ireland the following, you know, holidays. And then in the summer holidays, I spent about 2 months riding around Europe.
So you got the bug, basically, didn't you?
I got the travel bug. And yeah, I think as a child, we'd, you know, my father had these mad holidays where we were bundled into a car from a very early age and we were driven all around France and, you know, and we only had this mad, you know, obsession with the Michelin guide and we had to go and see every single castle or church or altarpiece. So we'd you know, as a family, we'd travelled very, very much from an early age.
Not very comfortable style.
Not very comfortable, no. But we travelled...
So you got used to that, so that wasn't part of your thing, was it?
No, and, but, you know, but because we'd travelled and because I was used to... seeing places and so I think really it was my when I was on my R6 on my BMW that I think the seed was sort of sown. I thought, wouldn't it be amazing if I could actually ride my bike around the world? But to then the world seemed a much larger place without all the technology that you have these days. It was a much, much larger place. And I didn't even know whether it was possible to ride a bike around the world.
Yes, I know. I'm interested because you went through Iran. I'm wondering now, would it be physically possible to do your journey again?
Probably not the same route there, but I think there's always a route.
So, is there a way around? Can we get through from, you know, India over to Europe still?
I don't know. I know that Afghanistan is obviously closed, I think. Iran, I think it's possible to get through Iran, but there's a huge amount of paperwork involved. And you might have to ship certain sections of it or something. I don't know. But I think. you know, people always say, when is the right time to do a round the world trip? And it's kind of never the right the time. You know, the right time has to be the right time for you to do it. And you just have to go out there and deal with whatever you have to deal with. And some countries might be closed, some countries might be open, and things will change when you're on the road anyway. So, you know, you can't think about that. You just have to go.
And luckily you were young, so in a way you didn't plan too much. And that's sort of quite good, isn't it? If you'd planned too much and you could have got too involved of a schedule, instead you could sort of think, oh, I'm going to change my mind today.
Yeah, you know? Exactly. And but I think it's also now, although all the information that's out there, I think people almost overplan their trips now. And I think they're almost, you know, because they can book all their hotels and almost work out where they're going to eat and what they're going to see. And, you know, their entire days of weeks and weeks and weeks traveling, every minute of their days is already pre-planned.
Which actually is quite boring.
I think it's really boring. Yeah. And it takes the whole sort of adventure out of the journey. You know, I mean, I felt, I know it might sound slightly odd, but I actually felt as if I was almost on the edge of exploration. You know, I was going out in the complete unknown.
Well, being the first woman, you know.
Well, I didn't know that at the time. I had no idea. And he kind of didn't really do things for that in those days. I only did it because it was something I wanted to do for myself.
Now, you also funded it yourself because you tried your hardest to get sponsorship. How did you earn the money to kind of fund it?
Well, basically, I finished my first 3 years architecture in the May of 1982, and it was a combination of being heartbroken, and I broke up with my boyfriend at the time in the February of that year. And I therefore found it really difficult to concentrate on any work of my final. So I did really bad in my degree. So I was kind of left with a pretty lousy degree, brokenhearted. And also in the early 80s, it was very difficult for architectural students to get placements anywhere, to get jobs. So I kind of thought, actually, now's the time to go. So I just sort of left.
But you saved up for months, didn't you?
Yeah, so then I started. So after I finished in the May, I then worked in a pub for 3 or 4 months. But I literally worked 7 days a week in a pub from 8 o'clock in the morning to 11 o'clock at night.
That's one thing I want to say. You've got incredible self-discipline. Where do you think you got that from?
I don't know, really. I think...
because you do have it.
Yeah.
You know, you could always think, I'm going this because I'm going to get there. You know what I mean? Whereas I'm someone that if I seize a cake, I just eat a lot. You know what I mean? Whereas you would say, no, I'm planning for tomorrow. Do you know what I mean? You were very...
exactly what I do, I don't. If I have a piece of cake, I will think, right, how many days can I make this last?
Exactly.
And I'll have a little bit every day. And to me, that's much nicer to do it like that because you kind of really appreciate it if you save it and savour it, then sort of eating the whole lot in one go.
Yeah, it's different personalities, isn't
it? Yeah,
I was worried, though, at one point you were told you might be getting scurvy because you were living off spaghetti and margarine.
Well, that was my... yes, well, I was desperately saving money, so I lived off a pretty pauper diet, and I did go to the dentist and he did say I had a mild form of scurvy, so I bought some vitamin C tablets and that seemed to do the trick. So,
okay, let's just go rewind back to your dad, because I do think, you know, your background wasn't normal. Tell us where you were brought up and how you lived, and tell us about your mum and dad.
Well, my father was a psychiatrist and he was very eccentric. He really was an extraordinary man.
Can you tell us in what way?
He just completely lived in his own world and he really didn't give, he didn't care.
You can swear.
Okay, he didn't give a shit about what anybody thought about him. He didn't care what he looked like. He didn't care what people thought. Nothing at all. He was just completely in his own world doing his own thing.
Hilarious.
And I really admired that.
Yeah.
I thought it was brilliant.
And he had obsessions, didn't he?
Well, he was very... he came from a very poor family. Mm. And so he was... he dropped out of school when he was about 16 with no O or A levels at the time. And then he was in a bad car accident. and went into hospital and decided, literally when he saw all the doctors in hospital, he said, that's what I want to do, I want to do medicine. So then he taught himself and he got his O levels, he got his A levels, and then he ended up going to Oxford and Cambridge.
Wow.
So he was, he had a brilliant mind. Mm-hmm. And he was also incredibly determined, but he did have a bit of an obsession about money.
Yeah.
I think because he'd come from a very poor family.
But also post-war. You know, everyone post-war, people very aware of saving things, make do and mend, not waste.
Yes,
you know.
And he would always be fixing things. And he was very good with his hands. And he would always, he had this amazing workshop in the basement where we lived in London. And I was always in there with him, helping him, I don't know, mend bits of furniture. And he could turn his hand to anything. I can remember once he got some lead off the roof because the gutter was leaking. And then he melted the lead down and then he shaped it into weights to put in the sash windows.
God.
And it's that sort of thing. Yeah. Nothing was wasted.
So he's an inventor as well.
Yeah, he just thought out of the box, and he would just never waste anything. And I think that's what I sort of learned from him.
Yeah, so you've got that. Because remember, you don't waste anything. Also, you are obviously good with your hands because on the journey, you were mending your own bike. How did you learn?
Well, I taught myself, basically. What? Before I left on my trip, I stripped my bike. Well, I stripped half of the engine down, so I could learn how it all worked. And I literally just bought myself a Haynes manual and a box of spanners, and that was it. And I just read, and I just took it apart. And
but you understood it, so you've obviously got that sort of mind that can understand.
Yeah, I do. I have a very practical mind, and I like to understand things. I understand how engines work, so that was easy to me. The sort of electrical side of my bike, I did not understand at all. And even to this day, I don't understand electrics and currents going through wires. And it just doesn't mean anything to me. To me, it's completely illogical. But engines, I understand.
So tell us about your beloved BMW, because obviously it was you and the BMW on the road.
Yeah, I mean, we had when I left on the trip, she was all
States.
I started off in America. Mm. I shipped her off to New York, and then I flew out to meet her. But she was already an old bike when I left.
Wow.
She was already 8 years old, and she had 45,000 miles on her, which for a motorbike was quite a lot of miles. So she was already quite old before I even started the trip. But she just became my companion. And, you know, we kind of looked after each other.
Fabulous.
So
I mean, I've had an emotional relationship with my first car. It's like, and I literally, and very sadly, the car got kind of taken away and taken to a yard and broken up because I couldn't pay for something.
Oh.
I was so up, you know, it was losing a sort of limb.
I know, it is. And I mean now, and even when I was riding her, and if we were going up a steep hill, I'd pat her on her tank and say, come on, old girl, we can make it. And, you know, and it was ridiculous things. I would promise her sort of, you know, oil changes if she got me to Penang on time or something.
But you know, the Japanese believe that material objects have a spirit.
Yeah,
so I think she obviously did.
Yeah, definitely. I always felt she had a spirit. And at that time, I had nothing else in the world. She was all I had, apart from the clothes on my back and my motorbike. She was it.
So you went to the States, and you were slightly used and abused there, and it toughened you up, didn't it, there?
It did. I mean, America was, that was the first, you know. And even though I'd travelled across America the year before, I'd flown out to Los Angeles, bought a BMW 750 and ridden it across to the East Coast the summer before I left on my trip. So that was partly why I chose to go around the way I did, because with my limited funds, I hoped I could at least get to Sydney and then I could work and save the money to do the second part of the trip. So, but it was quite tough, America. I think it was the first time I'd been on my own for such long periods of time, and learning to cope with with just being responsible for yourself and looking after yourself. And I mean, I was always fairly obsessional about looking after my bike. I mean, I would service her to death, you know, just to make sure that she'd get me round. And I mean, every morning.
But also, you had to sleep near her as well,
yeah,
didn't you?
Yeah. And every morning before I left on, you know, for the day's ride, I'd always check her over, check all the oil levels, check all her everything. I checked everything before I left. So, you know, but we, as I say, we both looked after each other.
So tell us one of your experiences in the States, and we'll go over to Australia.
Well, I had a bit of a run-in with a biker gang in California, I think it was, or New Mexico, somewhere on the West Coast. And I was riding on my own, obviously, and I saw these kind of bikes coming up behind me, and then they started to come either side of me, and then they tried to sort of box me in and ride me off the road.
Did they realise you're a woman?
Well, unfortunately, because I had long hair when I left on my trip, I had a long plait hanging down the back of my, you know, the back of my jacket. So, but then fortunately, they were on these, you know, ridiculous chopper bikes,
yeah.
Which
easy rider,
easy rider, yeah, which don't handle particularly brilliantly. And then fortunately, the road came to a load of really quite tight corners, and so I managed to outride them, which was really good. And I left them all behind me. So, but I remember I stopped for petrol shortly after that, and I remember to tuck my plait inside my jacket. So.
Fantastic. So then you got over to Sydney, and your bike was it, I think it was fine, it came over.
Yeah.
And then you kind of found, after a while, in the end, you found a job you really liked, and you lived there for a while, and then you set off, and it just wasn't as good as you thought it'd be, the roads, were they?
Yeah, I mean, Australia, I'd sort of, you know, imagined this thing of riding into the sunset,
yes,
on these beautiful
yeah.
roads, and yeah. it's all outback and yeah. free and nobody around, and how wonderful it was going to be. But actually, I found Australia incredibly hard work. It was really tough. It was just, you know, it was hot, it was dusty, the roads were terrible. We'd have these road trains coming, and you know, like a road train in Australia was basically a truck with three or four trailers on it, so it's about 150 feet long, and these things don't, you know, they don't move out of the way for a motorbike, so they just, you know.
How do you hear them coming?
You just see them, or you hear them behind you.
Are they fast?
Oh yeah, they're going 70, 80 miles an hour. I mean, they don't.
So they're killing everything.
Yeah, they're just, you know, they don't take any prisoners, as they say. So, you know, I had those to contend with, and most of the roads were just sort of single, you know, like a tarmac strip, wide enough for one vehicle, and then dust or dirt either side. So, of course, the road train would come along, and I'd be off into the dirt and the potholes and that. And it was just, you know, it was just everything. It was the distances as well. There were huge distances. And there weren't many roadhouses. There weren't many places to stop.
Yes, yeah, because there were just little huts full of kind of revolting men. Sorry, it did sound horrible. Kind of,
well,
sexist,
kind of
fat, drunk old
men. I mean, I'd sort of ride for 300 or 400 miles, and I'd see this little shack on the side of the road with a petrol pump, and I go, hey. And then there'd be a sort of small bar there, and it was all full of men. And, you know, half the time, almost they wouldn't, you know, they wouldn't actually serve me. And I'd have to go outside and drink out of a, you know, the tap outside. And it was just, I mean, I think things have changed, I would like to hope. But it was, you know, but out in the outback, it's a very harsh life. You know, it's you know, it's got to be one of the harshest environments that, you know, if you're kind of shearing sheep for 10 hours a day in 50 degrees in a tin hut, I mean, that's pretty grim.
Yeah, and so, no one around.
And no one around, and it's where kind of men are men, and, you know, it's all that whole thing.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was, and I did find it really, really tough.
But then the heavens opened. It was the worst rain in years.
Yeah, I was also, it seemed wherever I went, I seemed to get the worst weather, hadn't rained like this in seven years.
Yeah.
And so Central Australia, the there was a huge anti-cyclone came in, and it, I think it was about 4 or 5 inches of rain dumped in one night. So of course, the entire, and the South Road, the main road from Darwin down to Port Augusta, half of that was dirt road, and that was the main road, and it was 300 or 400 miles of just dirt road. Oh. And so that just turned into a huge bog. It was a lake and a bog, and it was just, I mean, you couldn't even stand up in it. It was just this thick, glutinous mud that you sank down, you know, almost down to your knees in. So, and that was just kind of Australia. Everything was harsh and difficult, and so, but you know, I managed. I got through it, but it certainly wasn't what I had imagined when I left Sydney, looking forward to this cruising around Australia.
Well, nothing was what you expected. That's the whole thing about this journey, wasn't it? That's why I couldn't stop reading it. It is impulsive reading because you just can't, you know, what the hell's going to happen to Elspeth next? Anyway, so then you went to Indonesia and you met up. In fact, there was a boyfriend, Mark. You didn't know whether you wanted him or not.
Yeah.
He was sort of around. You sort of liked him again, and you kind of, but he wasn't on a bike, so you kind of went on mini breaks with him around the place. Then we got to Thailand. Roads weren't that bad there. But I just want to talk about the story that, well, amused and shocked me was that when you went into the dog.
Well, I was riding from, because after going up to northern Thailand, I couldn't get through to India. So I had to ride back down to Malaysia to take a boat across from Penang to Madras. So I was in a little bit of a hurry, and it was the one time on the whole trip I actually had to be somewhere, because I'd arranged to meet my parents in Kathmandu in about 2 or 3 weeks' time. So I had to get all the way from Thailand down to Malaysia, across to Madras, and then ride up all through India into Kathmandu in 2 weeks. And I had no idea what the roads in India were going to be like. And so it was so I was riding probably a little bit too fast. And a truck was coming in the opposite direction, and a dog shot out from behind the truck, and I just didn't stand a chance. And it was a big dog, and so I kind of hit it head on, and I knocked off, slid up the road, my bike ended up in a ditch.
You broke two toes.
I broke my toes. And I'd rather stupidly, because it was so hot, I'd taken my gloves off, which I was really, the front of my hands had gone down, so all the front, they were absolutely bleeding and full of, earth and dirt and tarmac and my knees, and literally I was just bruised all over. I mean, fortunately I was wearing my leather jacket. I always wore my full face helmet. I had my bike boots, which I'd taken off, and I was just wearing some light shoes, which is why I broke my toes. But I was very lucky. It happened right outside this farm in Thailand. And all these people rushed out, and they were so kind to me, and they helped me get my bike out of the ditch, and then they kind of helped me kind of repair myself and bandage my hands, and then I stayed with them for 3 or 4 days, and they were so lovely and really, really kind to me. And then when I was leaving them and also the other thing I should say is after I hit the dog, and then in the confusion, with all the Thai family there and trying to get my bike out of the ditch, that I kind of noticed that the dog had gone, it had vanished. Mm. And I was kind of really annoyed, because I thought that, you know, I hadn't actually killed it. So there I was thinking,
being a British person, you're thinking, where's the dog?
Where's the dog? When it just vanished. So anyway, so 4 or 5 days later, when I was saying goodbye to the mother of the family, or the grandmother of the family in the kitchen, and there I saw on the table the dog I'd run over, but it was half eaten, so we'd been eating it for the last 4 or 5 days. So I tried not to look shocked or surprised, but I was really pleased, because at least I'd killed it.
Also, that you'd, as you say, you felt quite happy because you'd given something back.
Exactly. I'd fed the family for 2 weeks.
And yourself.
And myself, so yeah.
So how do you feel about having eaten dog?
It's meat's meat, to be honest with you, and I think in the Western world, we see dogs as pets. It's a very different thing. In other countries of the world, they view different animals in different ways. It's but basically meat is meat.
So you got over to India, and you had to do and again. Well, I think India sounded the kind of most stressful place you went to. It was unbelievable. I mean, I couldn't believe the stories in it. But you did manage to, you didn't have to ride all the way up to see your parents, did you?
No, because by the time I got to Madras, because I'd been so held up with the accident and everything, I stayed with an Indian family in when we docked in Madras, and they suggested I put my bike on a train. So I trained my bike from Madras up to Kathmandu, and then I just rode from Kathmandu up, sorry, from Madras to Calcutta, and then I rode up from Calcutta to Kathmandu.
So you saw your parents?
And then I saw my parents.
Oh my God.
Which was a very weird experience. Yeah, yeah. Very weird.
You're both out of your, you're both in different comfort zones and thinking different things and yeah. feeling different things.
Yeah, but it was odd because I kind of hoped that they would, you know, that they would understand or appreciate that I had actually sort of achieved something. But they were almost completely indifferent to it all. It was very weird. And I think it was my, I mean, my dad was in his own little world. He was always in his own little, but my mum, I think it was just her way of dealing with it. I think she couldn't, she almost wanted to try and remove herself from what I was doing.
Yeah, like the pain.
Yeah.
And the fear.
And imagine the worry and the, you yeah, know, she was, yeah. I mean, if yeah. I mean, if mothers now mm. can imagine what they would feel like if their 23-year-old daughter just left to ride a motorbike around the world,
yeah.
completely into the unknown. Yeah. And also then, there wasn't any way of actually staying in contact. I mean, I used to phone home once every 3 weeks, and that was it. And, you know, the odd letters we'd manage to pick up in, from post offices or I'd send home. So there was very little, you know. So my poor old mum, she was...
She could have just been worried nonstop. Instead, yeah. she parked it in a way, didn't she?
Yeah, you know? She did, exactly. That was just her way of dealing with
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Although at the time I found it hard to... Because I sort of felt that she didn't really acknowledge what I was doing or acknowledge my achievement.
I do think that was part of the reason you did it. There was a bit of you that wanted your parents' approval.
There was, definitely, definitely. Mm. I mean, I was very much a middle child.
Yes, I am too.
And that kind of says it all. So we're always out to, you know, to prove ourselves.
Yeah, exactly. And we never get what we want either.
Well, we kind of do.
If we learn that we've got to value it internally
yes,
instead.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. Yeah. And actually, we kind of do get it. And I think we actually get a lot more. We just get it not in the way we think we want it or the way we think it's going to come to us.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. That's true. So Mark was around again, wasn't he?
Yes, I met Mark in... Mark joined us in Kathmandu. He'd been travelling in India and he joined us in Kathmandu. And then I went on a 3.5-week trek with Mark.
And that was interesting because you set off thinking, I'm not really into walking, I'm not really into this, but you adored it.
It was just being in the mountains. It was just amazing. It was, and I think it was being in the mountains where there were no roads, no cars, nothing. Everybody walked everywhere. And it was just so, I mean, the scenery was stunning, the people were lovely. It was like this little oasis of, it was amazing. Although the walk nearly killed me, because I am not a walker. I mean, I was sort of biker fit, but I certainly wasn't walking fit. And I had no walking boots. I just had to hire boots in some shop in Kathmandu, so they didn't fit particularly well. I didn't have a proper rucksack. I just had a little day pack. So I certainly didn't have any of the gear or equipment to do a long trek or a long walk. But it was amazing.
Would you recommend that as a thing to do?
Definitely, yeah. Definitely. It really was. It's like you really do feel as if you're in a part of the world that nobody can touch you.
Fabulous.
That's what was great.
Yeah, and probably the quiet and, you know, just all the things. And as you say, you'd see people walk, you know, getting anything delivered to their home, they'd have to carry a bed
Everything was carried everywhere. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I remember there was this guy, one of the porters. I mean, all the trails were just full of these porters carrying stuff up and down the mountains. And there was one guy that had this huge pack on his back, and it was about 8 foot high, and it was just cigarettes.
Oh, wow.
It must have been 1,000 of cigarettes. So it was really light, but it was huge. This thing was really...
That's worth a lot of money.
I know.
Yeah, I'm surprised you survived. So, yeah.
You know, and if families, you know, if you wanted to go and see your brother or your sister, you know, you walked for 3 days. You saw them and then you walked back. It was just a completely different mentality. Yeah,
well,
it
must
way
have
of
been
thinking
how we were once.
Exactly,
much.
Exactly. Yeah. And it was nice sort of going also from being on a bike to actually walking, where it's a much slower pace.
Mm, you can take more in.
You can take more in. Mm. It's just a completely different way of travelling. And I really liked that mix of sort of, you know, leaping off a bike and then kind of completely slowing down and just walking. It was amazing.
Now, when you were there, when you got back on your bike, you met up with another biker, Robert, and you just suddenly, it was so brilliant to meet someone who was doing, was he doing the same journey as you?
Well, he had emigrated out to Australia and then realised decided he didn't want to live there. Mm. So
he was Dutch.
Mm. So he shipped all his things back home and decided to ride his bike from Sydney. So he'd come over from Sydney and he'd actually heard about me in Australia and he'd heard about me in Malaysia and Thailand and he really wanted to meet me. And then I think by the time he got to India, he gave up hope of ever meeting me. But anyway, we met in Kathmandu. Literally, he was riding down the road and I was riding the other way and we just kind of stopped dead, you know, because people didn't travel on the bikes in those days. He was the first overland traveller I'd seen on a bike.
What?
People didn't do it. And he was the first overland traveller on a bike I had seen on my whole trip. The first and only one I met.
Unbelievable.
Because it was just... now everybody goes around the world on a motorbike, you know, darling. But, you know, then you just didn't do it. People didn't do it.
Gosh.
I think the world was a lot scarier place because you couldn't find out about anything and because you didn't know what was out there. It just seemed a lot, I don't know, because of the unknown, I think it just sort of scared people a lot.
Mm-hmm. But you had so much in common with him, didn't you?
Yeah, we instantly clicked. I mean, it was just... I remember when we met, we literally sat... we sat on the steps of this trekking shop for about 3.5 hours and just talked and talked and talked all about our similar experiences and India and Thailand and Malaysia and Australia and... And then we arranged, and then because at the time I was very much with Mark, but Mark was, I think, was keen that I sort of teamed up with Robert because he was very worried about me riding because I had the difficult countries to come, really, India, Pakistan, and Iran. I mean, they were kind of difficult. Iran was at war with Iraq, and so it was all a bit. And so I think Mark was, he was quite keen that I had a fellow traveller. So I agreed to meet up with Robert about 2 weeks or 3 weeks later in Agra or Delhi, I can't remember. And then we travelled from there. We travelled up through Kashmir and up to Leh and Ladakh, which was just absolutely amazing. And then back down and then through Pakistan and Iran and Turkey and all the way back to Holland.
Now, that I'm not going to go into detail about what happened with him, but it is the most moving part of your book. Because I can't tell, because people have got to read the book, haven't they? I just want to talk about, so you ended up in Europe and it was November and you had these very thin clothes on and you were trying to get across the Alps and you were freezing.
It was, and also I'd been in hot countries for a year and a half.
Yes,
so I'd been used to sort of 30, 40 degrees for a year or two. So to suddenly, and all our clothes were really, they were all worn out, they had holes in them, you know, we didn't even have that. I mean, literally, I just had a leather jacket and some plastic over thing. That's all I had. My gloves were worn virtually completely through. Because Robert got hepatitis when we were in Turkey, he was in hospital there, so we got stuck there for 3 or 4 weeks. So we were hoping to be, you know, to get over the Alps sort of September, October time, whereas in reality it was November before.
The snow was on the ground.
It was snowing, it was so cold. We could only ride for 30 minutes at a time, and then we had to warm up somewhere, and then we'd get out and we'd ride another 30 minutes, and then because we were just so cold.
Wow.
And we made sort of muffs for our on our handlebars for, you know, to keep our hand, or an attempt to keep our hands dry, and we made them out of concrete, you know, of plastic concrete bags that we found in an old builder skip, and we weaved bits of wire in it and put.
Sounds like the sort of thing your dad would do.
Yeah, exactly.
He'd be wearing it all the time.
He would, yes. It was very practical, but it did help. But it was still fantastic. So cold.
So you got back to England in the end, and it was an anticlimax, wasn't it?
It was a huge anticlimax. I found it incredibly difficult to kind of relate to anybody. I found that really nobody could understand what I'd been through, and actually kind of nobody really wanted to know.
That's really sad.
And, you know, I'd sort of imagined that there, you know, that some people would be interested in what I'd achieved. But
especially, magazines, newspapers. Just think nowadays, you would have had, I mean, you tried to get sponsorship, you didn't get sponsorship. When people wrote about you, it was sexist, it was damning, it was taking the mickey.
I know.
I mean, just think how much the world's changed.
I know. Yeah. Fortunately, it has changed.
And you probably, this is the right time to bring the book out because, you know, before people, you know what I mean? It's like you'd be taken more seriously anyway.
Yeah, I know. And I, you know, when I got back, I had vaguely thought about writing a book. But I think just because of the total lack of interest from anybody. And I thought, well, if my friends and my family don't want to know, well, no one's going to want to know my story. So
Elspeth, what made you write it now then? Apart from the big thing about Robert, which we know, which we can't give away.
No. Yeah. Well, in 2008, I was contacted. In 2008... there was somebody who works for BMW, and they asked a friend of mine to write a short article about my story. So this friend of mine wrote the article, and BMW put it up on their international website. And that was the very first time I got any publicity for my story at all. And I got back in 84, and it took from 2008 before I got anything. And I didn't put it out there. To me, the story was a kind of part of my life that was now gone, finished, closed. You know, I'd moved on. I'd done umpteen other things. And, you know, all of my tapes, my diaries, my photos, they were just sat in a cardboard box in the back of a cupboard for 30 years. So the story went on the internet, and it was picked up by various other motorcycle websites. And then gradually over the years, over about 5 or 6 years, that the story gained momentum. And it was a producer in LA, or an agent in LA, who contacted me and wanted to buy the rights to my story to make a film.
That's cool.
I had to rush to the cupboard to make sure I still had everything. So they flew me out to Los Angeles, and I met a whole load of producers and screenwriters and everything.
Glamorous.
It was very glamorous. I was chauffeured around everywhere. I felt like a star. It was lovely. But I think it was then that I realised how little of my story I had actually remembered. I mean, it was a long, long time. I mean, I hadn't read any of my diaries in 30 years. Mm. I mean, obviously, I knew the route I'd gone, but all the details of it and who I met and...
Because that was a great thing. There is so much detail in the book.
Yeah, well, fortunately, I kept a reasonably good diary. Mm. I used to send these micro cassette tapes home because my dad sent me out it, because that was another, he was a real techie fan. And so he sent me out a little micro cassette recorder when I was in Sydney. So I used to talk into this machine every night or every other night or whatever. And when the tape was full, I'd send it home. Mm. And he kept all my tapes. So I had all my tapes from Sydney all the way back home. And I've also got thousands of photographs. And so it was just piecing it all together. But listening to myself was really weird. It was really...
Was it like listening to you? Or do you think it was slightly like listening to another person? Because you develop so much. You know what I mean? It's like, is that really me?
It was like listening to a different person. Yeah. It really was. But in some ways, that was kind of quite good because I could write it almost...
Yes, like one step away.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah.
So anyway, so then I decided that now was the time to write the book. So that's how the book came about. And that was about, I think I went out to Los Angeles in 2015, so it's taken me 2.5 years.
Fantastic. You've got a publisher and you're out. Is it out now?
It's out tomorrow, the 6th of July.
Fantastic.
So it's out tomorrow.
Elspeth Beard, Lone Rider, the first woman to motorcycle around the world, is published by Michael O'Mara Books. Elspeth, thank you so much for coming on to Radio Gorgeous. Can I just say that you have had a gorgeous life? And I commend you.
Thank you very much.
And for more fascinating women, go to radiogorgeous.com. This is Josephine Pembroke signing out with Elspeth Beard.